my first reaction when Pee Wee Herman says that he's not trying to be weird is like, come on. But like, it's exactly the same. I'm no Pee Wee Herman, but it's exactly the same when people ask me about myself. I like, no, I'm not trying to be weird. I'm just trying to make something that's new. And if it comes out a little bit weird to the average sensibility, then I guess that's my problem to bear.
Hey everybody, it's You Make a Trip to Verse. It's Josh, Brenna, and John here for Team Versi. And if I don't do the formal introduction, it is only because I'm going off book and off script today, because today is a special occasion, not only because our guest, Adam Rex, is amazing, inspiring, and has covered a lot of ground and a lot of fresh hilarity in his more than 20-year kids book children's lit career, but also, as of this episode, April 16th, 2024, this podcast is 5 years old. I cannot thank enough every one of you who has listened and continues to listen and engage with the podcast, for all of you who get something out of it, for Brenna for joining me in the chair along the way and making this everything that it is today, and for John for being the backbone of our operation today. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We love doing this podcast, and we can't wait to bring 5 more years. But for now, check out Adam Rex. I don't need to do any other introduction of Adam. He speaks for himself, and here is Adam Rex's verse.
Anyways, I think
I've never
Korea.
Been to Korea.
Well, I need to go get a drink of water. I foolishly ate a handful of granola right before sitting down, and now I have like a piece of coconut stuck in the back of my throat. So I'll be right back.
Sure. Okay. Right. I swear I have lots more things to say than just about Korea.
I'm sure. I mean, that's been my history, at least.
Yeah.
I don't think this would have continued as long as it has.
Yeah, right. If I only wanted to talk about Korea on the podcast.
Yeah, you may contribute a soul.
Nice. Well done. So many of our guests would have tapped out. Like, I don't know what this podcast is about.
Children's lit author, what do you know about Korea?
Right.
These are our five-minute episodes.
Oh my God.
You know, it's funny, while we were there...
Okay, well, yeah. So this is a great segue.
While we were there, coincidentally, there was actually a show going on of the work of Mac Barnett and John Clawson in a museum just outside of Seoul, and right next to a big Hyundai department store. So we went and visited that. And I guess the nice side effect of there being a big show about Mac's work is there was actually a little section about me, since he and I have done so many books together. So while I was there, I was able to go to a museum.
Did you know?
Had a tiny
Were you aware
section.
Of that?
I just happened to.
That's awesome.
I was over at Max some time ago, and he told me that the show was coming. And when I realized it was actually going to overlap with our time in Korea, it was kind of hard to pass up. So we made a day of it. And, you know, the food court of the Hyundai department store is actually worth a trip anyway. So it was a pretty good day.
A nice little double whammy.
Yes, I saw pictures. Yeah, I saw pictures of that on Instagram. And I actually remember thinking like, oh my gosh, that's so cool. They're in Korea. I wonder if it coincided with your trip, because we had talked, you know, like earlier in the summer that you were going. So I had wondered. That's awesome that you guys were able to see it. And you were just in the museum with them.
That must feel surreal. I would imagine, Adam.
It did. It felt, you know, very special because I have this special personal, you know, connection with Korea because of my son being from there. And so, yeah, I mean, already whenever I get like a Korean translation of one of my books or something like that, it always seems a lot more special and fun than getting, you know, a Greek translation, a French translation, whatever. And so, yeah, that was amazing. And my son was bouncing off the walls while we were there because he started to understand that I wasn't going to tell them who I was and why we had come there to visit that particular museum. So he finally, I thought he was going to have a heart attack. So I ended up telling a couple of staffers who I was, and they took some pictures and so forth. But and then later, the director of the museum like emailed me and said, well, you were here? Like you didn't tell us ahead of time? We had no idea you were here. So I don't know, next time I should do it right, but I don't know. I was very torn between
Yeah, but you're there
wanting
on
to
vacation.
make a spectacle of myself and not wanting to make a spectacle of myself.
Yeah, I would imagine too, it's kind of fun to go in sort of incognito. I mean, I've mentioned this before on the podcast, like as far as, picture book authors go, you're not super, I mean, you're like your name is well known. And I would imagine, out of the handful of picture book writers that people could recognize on the street, you might be one of them. Maybe Mac Barnett, maybe Amy Dyckman, because she's got, blue hair most of the time. But like most other people, like their name, but you don't generally know their face. So I think it's, pretty easy to sort of like, go in undetected, which might be kind of fun, to just hear what people are saying and or observe instead of being, front and center.
Yeah, except I don't speak Korean, so there's no danger of me being able to overhear what people are saying. Hang out in the Adam Rex section and wait until somebody says something complimentary about me. I guess might be able to pick up the word,
Just leave
door
your
or
Google
something like,
Translate.
oh, they said good. That's good. But no, my son is learning Korean. We're getting him private lessons, but any Korean he picked up before the age of 22 months, he lost again, and now he's trying to get it back.
Korean is surprisingly like easy to learn, easier than some of the other, Asian languages that have different characters, because that in and of itself is another layer. Like most of the other languages that we're used to, like Spanish, French, German, they all, use our same letters at least, so the sounds are similar. But when you learn an Asian language, it's like, well, these are all characters with totally different sounds and meanings, and so having to learn that is a whole other thing. But the Korean language is actually scientifically based, and so they sort of built it in a really logical way. So once you start to learn it, it makes a lot more sense. It was easier to pick up than like Japanese. Japanese was really hard. They've got three alphabets. It was insane. So
Oh, I didn't know that. But yeah, I think the Korean alphabet is so recent. I think that's interesting that, obviously some thought went into it. And I usually tell people that you can, get Duolingo or something. You can probably pick up the Korean alphabet in like an afternoon. You won't know any words, but it serves me to the extent that when my son needs somebody to quiz him on his vocabulary, I can tell whether he's saying the word correctly or not by, looking at the Hangul. But that and probably like a dozen different words and phrases is about as far as my knowledge goes at this point.
I think it's fascinating though that we've done this podcast for so long now, and I didn't know, Brenna, that you spoke Korean. We could talk a blue streak about the value of Duolingo though.
Josh loves Duolingo.
Yeah. It doesn't
Well, yeah, I
Korean
keep
the Korean
trying
language
it.
has not tended to come up very frequently on this podcast thus far.
Yeah, and I keep trying Duolingo, and I keep hitting a wall. And I think some part of that wall is just, my own laziness. But I get several lessons in, and I just realize stuff isn't sticking anymore. And so I don't know. Maybe after Henry gets a little more versed, then I can practice on him some more and maybe get a little farther than I have in the past.
Well, okay. So we're here to talk about books. So we'll segue from Hangul and Korea. But so I wanted so let's talk about Gumluk first, because oh my gosh. So first of all, I loved it. It was super fun and really quirky and very like a fast read and just really like all around just like very Adam Rexy like humor, and it was really fun to read. And I read recently it has 4-star reviews, which is incredible. Congratulations.
Thank
And
you.
then I only recently found out you have a blog, which I subscribe to immediately. But I was reading the last post that you read about how roughly 5 years ago you were actually fired from a project, which that's crazy to me. And also just makes you seem, like human and sort of, you know, one of us, which is like really nice and sort of refreshing that, like, you know, you don't always, like, you know, you're not always, you also get rejections, or you also get like fired from things. And so that blog post was kind of, was really inspiring. And I also love how you talk about the impetus for Gumluck, which I would love to hear more about, and those key raccoons.
Yeah, that was an interesting project. And I'm afraid I won't end up saying too much about the one I got fired from, because I, you know, I still feel like I ought to be discreet about that. It is a book that actually came out eventually with a different creative team. But it was a very tricky book, a very unusual book, a book that nobody really knew what it should look like when we were working on it. So, you know, I worked on that book pretty consistently for a couple of years before finally actually getting the green light to go ahead and start painting and composing finished illustrations. There were still a handful of pages that we were, you know, still hashing out and trying to figure out the specifics of, but otherwise I had this go ahead to make finished illustrations. And I kind of made about half the book when I found out that, you know, I was being let go off of it, that they were, you know, they were going to cancel my contract and try to go in a different direction. So that was, I mean, it was devastating in its way, but also, as I write on in my newsletter post that you're referencing, like, I feel like the strongest feeling I felt in that moment was actually a sense of relief, because this book had become this albatross around my neck that I mean, it's going to sound like a very, like, young adult novel sort of a phrase to say, but it was a weight that I hadn't really felt until it was suddenly lifted. And now I just realized, oh, now I can just make anything I want. I had this freedom in this block of time where nobody was really expecting anything from me. So at that time, I was really loving these illustrations by an illustrator named Lauren Petipis. I hope I'm saying her last name right. I've only ever seen it in print, but it absolutely looks like it should be pronounced Petipis. And she was just my favorite thing about Twitter in 2018. She was always posting these drawings of like mischievous little raccoons getting into business and like woodland parties and mice dressed as knights and, you know, goblins and stuff like that. And these drawings made me feel a certain way, and I decided I wanted to write something that made me feel like Lauren's raccoon drawings made me feel. So I set out to write a book that doesn't have any raccoons in it. It's about a silly little wizard who really, really wants to be a hero. And he is a hero because he helps everyone that he meets, but the trouble is he wants the people and the town to love him for it, and they all think he's a noodlehead. So it's about his struggle, and the book is narrated by a raven named Helvetica, who actually is the only character who has a genuine beef against Gumluck the wizard, but she's also the one that sort of falls for him in the end. And it also has the amnesiac ghost in it, who may or may not be the ghost of an ice cream scoop that fell off of an ice cream cone and melted. And I did what I set out to do. I made this story that's just, I think it's sweet and funny and gentle, but it also has a little action and conflict in it. And it was just exactly the book I set out to write.
Do you set out to... I say this with all of the enthusiasm and positivity inherent in my own desire to get weird. But do you set out to get weird and depict the ghost of an ice cream scoop, or do these things emerge as part of the process?
They emerge as part of the process, but honestly, I feel like this always sounds disingenuous when people say it. I feel like sometimes I don't believe other people when I hear them say that, like, no, I don't think this is weird. Recently I was listening to an old interview with Paul Rubens, Pee Wee Herman, because of course we lost him recently. And I think the interviewer was sort of insinuating that that he was weird on purpose. And I, you know, when Paul Rubens is telling you, no, I'm not trying to be weird. I like none of that was meant to be weird. It was just, I'm trying to, you know, he's trying to create something new. He's just following the map that is, has been made inside of his head through all of his experiences and hobbies and interests and loves all throughout his life. And he's following that map to where it leads. And I realized that I feel like my first reaction when Pee Wee Herman says that he's not trying to be weird is like, come on. But like, it's exactly the same. I'm no Pee Wee Herman, but it's exactly the same when people ask me about myself. I like, no, I'm not trying to be weird. I'm just trying to make something that's new. And if it comes out a little bit weird to the average sensibility, then I guess that's my problem to bear. And maybe it's a good problem to have, because if I'm creating something that is new and specific to what I want to make and what I like, then I'm going to find other people that feel strongly about it as well, because it resonates with them. But it also means that I'm going to lose some people, I suppose. Some people are going to think, well, this is just weird. You know, this is just weird for weirdness sake. Where with the story of Gumluck the Wizard, I mean, what I really want to do is warm your heart and break your heart a little bit and then warm it all over again. And I feel like more than anything, it's a book that's just sweet and has a lot of heart. So yeah, you know, some people are going to focus on the fact that there's a little ghost of an ice cream scoop in this story. And, you know, that's, I'll just have to understand, as we all do, if we're trying to create something that is really personal and deeply felt, that it's not going to be personally deeply felt by a lot of other people who just aren't on the same wavelength that we are.
Yeah.
I kind of love that though. Like, first of all, Ghost of an Ice Cream Scoop is kind of genius. I mean, I love that because a little ghost, I mean, looks kind of like an ice cream scoop. Like, it's kind of perfect. I don't know, like, why nobody else ever put that together before. But I also, okay, so everybody says, like, there's no story that hasn't already been told. So our job as writers is to tell it from our point of view, or to tell it, you know, with our spin on it. And I feel like weird is just another word for that, you know, for voice or quirky or new. Like, I love that you said the word new. You know, you're just trying to create something new, because it's like, yeah, I am telling, you know, this heartwarming story. And it is about, you know, it's sort of a hero's journey. I mean, Gumluck is a noodlehead, but he's also, you know, he's trying to like make it through this story, and he has an end goal and he runs into obstacles, but he does it in a whole new way, in a way that I feel like is really appealing to kids, because kids want something new. They don't want the boring stuff. Like, I read a book to my kid earlier this morning, and it was basically just like a list of like facts about robots. And he was like, oh, he's like, dud. Like, it was so boring. He just didn't like, you know, he didn't connect with it. Like, he wasn't impressed. But if I read something to him that is, you know, out there and he connects with, then he really is like invested and interested, which is, you know, the whole point. Like, that's what we're all trying to do as writers. So I don't know, like, I kind of love that you're, you know, putting it in those terms, and it is something new and something that people can connect with.
The funny thing too about writing for kids is that so much of everything is new for them. So really, I probably don't have to go to this much effort. You know, all of the typical tropes of storytelling are always going to be new to someone the first time they hear them, you know? So every kid's book has the opportunity to be new, when the first time that some kid has ever encountered some well-worn trope that the adult reader might see coming from a mile away. But I also think when we're making books for kids, we are making them for the kids, but it's also equal parts, we're making them for ourselves. And if we're not trying to make something that we love, then what's the point? So we need, I think, to love the thing that we're making so that the love will then transmit and transfer and radiate onto the reader, and they'll feel that, okay, this thing was made with love. This book, this song, this well-organized play date, this batch of muffins, all of these things were made with love, and I can feel that, and that's part of the experience of taking them in. So, I mean, you sort of underscore the kind of funny, like the catch 22 of this whole thing, that I'm trying so hard to create something new, and I'm like, it's all new to kids, but really, by creating something new that I can feel proud of and I can love, then I can pass that love on to the readers, young and old. Hopefully they feel it.
I guess my prepared reaction to what you just said was sort of there's a permission that we as authors and creators need from those who accept our work. And a lot of us who are creators n need to a certain degree, fit into a publishability mold. And that's not to say that weird is not possible. But it at least needs to have a foot in the door. And I think what is interesting about your work and your body of your career is, at least to me, and maybe there's a through line that you can relate, but at least to me, that there seems to be that transgression, that creative transgression throughout everything that you've done, that creation of something new. Do you feel that way? Have you always felt that way, that urge to create something new? And has it rather than fit specifically into a mold, and has it created, or have there been challenges, I guess, in fighting for your vision?
Well, there's always challenges, and there's always the publishability, excuse me, publishability angle. It's, I don't think about a whole lot until I'm being rejected, and then, I realize, oh, right, I have to think about publishability because nobody wants the story I wrote, but I'm not thinking about it when I'm making the stories. And where the stories come from is just a matter of, I'm getting ideas all the time, but it's only the ideas that actually take root and really take hold of me that I actually keep working on and developing, and eventually sit down and start writing the thing. And once written, pass it on to my agent to see if there's anything there. So it already has to have some spark of something, or I don't keep thinking about it. And I guess that spark of something is the thing that ends up feeling either new or weird, depending on your sensibility. But I might get ideas about a kid who's nervous about his first day of school all the time. My kid doesn't want to go to school in the morning. I have that idea for a picture book 7 times a week. But, unless you do something else with it, there's no need for another book in which a kid is nervous about his first day of school. But, when somebody is complaining about how there are too many books about kids who are nervous about their first day of school, and that makes me think a school is nervous about his first day of children, then that's the new angle that makes me think, oh, wait, there's something there. So I need to keep thinking about that, because maybe that's a book, and then eventually, it turns into one. And that is, for anyone not familiar, is one of my books. It's called School's First Day of School, and came out some years ago. It was illustrated by Christian Robinson. So, like, again, it's not like an intention to set out to be either publishable or weird. It's just, I'm always thinking of things, and it's like, of all the things that I think of, what do I end up caring about? And what I end up caring about is the thing that's a little different, or has some spark of life in it that I don't feel like I've quite seen or run across before. Because otherwise, I'm just not going to be interested in thinking about it any further. And so then the tension is, I finally make that thing, and then I send it out to my agent, or my agent sends it out into the world, and I find out exactly which side of the publishability line it lands on. But sometimes I don't find that out until later.
So I just want to circle back just a little bit. So, like finding that creative spark and that thing that like really like holds on to you, and you're like, okay, this is an idea I can really sort of like work on and put out into the world. Has that gotten easier, I guess, to recognize? I mean, for lack of a better term, that's like part voice, right? Like that's what everybody is, this elusive voice everybody's always looking for. And to be able to put your spin on it and the idea and get everything, you know, working and create this small miracle, you know, that is a publishable book to recognize over the years. I mean, I would imagine so. And I guess I'm tying this back into what you said about rejection and just, you know, having an idea that sticks and then having one that doesn't stick. I guess I wonder, you know, how many projects are you putting out that actually get rejected? Because I feel like at this stage in your career, you've gotten really good at noticing and identifying what works, what doesn't work, what you want to work on, and what's going to, you know, sell into the world. So are there pieces that you're putting out that you really love that, you know, just aren't getting any traction that do get rejected?
Yeah, I suppose I should actually like do an audit at some point and figure out what the actual numbers are. But I have a sense that maybe for every three things that I write, one of them makes it all the way, you know, over the finish line. But frankly, I like most of the time that's because my agent is telling me, I don't think this is it. I'm trying to think of the last time I actually wrote something. My agent was behind it. We sent it out and nobody wanted it. There's been cases where like maybe it didn't receive quite the reception we were hoping for, that, you know, we didn't get a six publishing house auction going, trying to fight over who gets the, you know, privilege of being able to publish this thing that I made. We sent it out to a bunch of people and then in the end, only one house wants it, maybe. Sometimes it is multiple houses, but, usually it's my agent who's stopping something in its tracks. And usually he's stopping something that I sort of knew was not really quite right anyway, but I put enough effort into it that I was going to make somebody else read it. And I was going to make him tell me. And sometimes I don't really have the right sense of things either. What's a good example of there was a story I wrote a while back called Exo Ox. It's an epistolary picture book of these letters between an ox and the gazelle that he admires and her disinterested replies. And I kind of thought, well, this one is probably, like, I'm glad I finished it. It's probably not going to make its way into the world. My wife, I don't mean to throw my wife under the bus. She's very supportive, but she didn't really think that this one was probably that anyone was going to want it. And my agent was hugely enthusiastic about it. And we sold it right away. And it, you know, it's a book. So I don't always know. And I do appreciate that I have an agent that understands the business better than I do and has, I think, a very wise sensibility and often has a very good idea of what's going to land and what isn't and why. And maybe that'll give me the impetus to go back and figure out how to turn something that isn't 100% there into something that is.
Yeah. Shout out for those who may not be aware that your agent, I don't think we've said his name yet, Steve Malk, at Writer's House. So has he been your career agent? I assume you have been pretty strong collaborators for a while.
It has been a long time. He hasn't been with me for the entirety of my career, but for almost all of it. I managed to land my first couple of books just on the strength of being an illustrator, that as an illustrator, it's a lot easier to get your stuff noticed. And I don't think that agents are quite as necessary for that aspect of things. An agent is still necessary for me because I don't want to read contracts and I'm bad at asking for things. And so I need Steve for that. But I didn't need him to get my first book because sending 1,000 postcards out into the world got me my first book. You know, sending out tear sheets, you know, in the 1990s got me my first book in the year 2000. And that was a book called The Dirty Cowboy. It was written by Amy Timberlake, and I was brought on to illustrate that. And so having created a relationship with an editor at Farrar, Straus & Giroux for that book, he kept me in mind for a second book called Steamboat A-Comin'. That was my second picture book by Jill Ethbaum. you know, having gotten people interested in my illustration, I was always able to get them to read my writing as well, which is sort of an unfair advantage that illustrators have. You know, we can send out a postcard. It's almost harder not to look at a postcard than it is to look at one. So when the postcard comes to the editor's desk, they look at it, they decide whether they're interested or not. If you can make things really easy for them, just, you know, send them a packet of tear sheets of illustrations with a return postcard where they can just check a box whether they're interested or not in getting further submissions. That's the kind of thing that I did back in the 90s. And then, you know, I found that whenever I had anybody on the hook that they liked my illustration work and had said, please keep sending me new illustrations, keep me updated, we'll see if we can find something for you. If I asked them then, would you like to read my writing? They always said yes. Because of that, I managed to get my first book as both author and illustrator. It wasn't quite under contract yet, but somebody at Harcourt had agreed to publish it. And that's when Steve called. Steve called me because he represents Amy Timberlake, the author of The Dirty Cowboy, my first picture book. And he had seen the printer's proofs that were coming back from that and thinking, I want to represent more illustrators. Let's see if this guy wants representation. So people ask me all the time, like, how do you get an agent? And my helpful answer is illustrate a picture book that is noticed by one of the top picture book and children's book agents in the business, and then have him call you and ask you if you want to be represented. And then when he does that, you say yes, and then you have an agent, which is not really replicable and unfair and, you know, a terrible answer, but that's the only answer I know. I very much lucked into representation. I never really got to the phase where I even was researching agents. It just kind of dropped into my lap. So Steve's been with me since maybe early 2000, and I've been working with him ever since. Yeah, I think we have a very good relationship.
Past 20 years, yeah.
As agent and client, as friends, and as just somebody who, like, a really good, trusted reader of my work, because I'm not a part of a writer's group or anything like that. Apart from my wife, nobody really, you know, sometimes my son, nobody really reads my work before it goes out to Steve.
I was going to ask about a critique group, yeah, whether or not you had any, or even just like peers, like if you just call up Mac sometimes and you're like, hey, can you look at this? But it sounds like no. Have you always operated that way? Like just sort of like on your own and like sending stuff out?
Pretty much. Mac and I did used to send each other stuff every now and then. We've fallen out of the habit of that, but you know, we did do that from time to time, but never as, you know, it never is any codified thing. And I've never had a regular critique group. So really, I lean on Steve a lot, I guess, because even my wife, like, she's a teacher, so she's too busy to always help me out with every thing that I've written before I decide to send it out there.
Hey, real quick break for some mid-ep shoutouts and reviews, and I am no more prepared for this mid-ep break than I was for the intro, because we're just winging it today. I do want to call out three names though before I get to the reviews, just to quickly shout out. First is a historical shout out. Shout out to Jeremy, my brother, who was the first guest on this podcast and gamely showed up to have a chat with me for an hour that was recorded, I think like early March 2019 as the first historical recording of this podcast. So thanks, Jeremy. Second one, shout out to Jenny Gorbach, a recent guest on the podcast along with Audrey, but Jenny and I had a brief exchange on X/Twitter about me doing my Grover impression. Jenny hears me drawing a line in the sand that I will not do the Grover impression on the podcast. We will save that for another time. Third and most legitimate shout out is to Kiara Columbi, with whom we recorded an awesome episode of the podcast last week as of this recording. Kiara is a sustaining Patreon member, so thank you to Kiara for supporting the podcast as well as being on it in a future episode. And now, however, for some reviews. So our reviews are three. Brenda's review for this week is How to Make a Peanut Butter Sandwich in 17 Easy Steps by Bambi Edlund. This book has so many steps and so many pieces involved. To get one simple solution, it would make Rube Goldberg proud. Kids and grown-ups will delight in the fun antics of completing this basic task. This book is fun for the fun of it, and Bambi's playful illustration complete this adorable romp. I have seen too many peanut butter and jelly the wrong way or the long way videos on TikTok to have any proper expectations for what this book would be like. That's my commentary, not Brennis. John's review this week is A Little Like Waking, which we talk about in this conversation with Adam, by the one and only Adam Rex in an illustrated YA take, who marries YA romance with suspense and adventure, all wrapped up with a hefty Inception-esque overtone. The story is brilliant, and true to John's bias towards black and white artwork, the artwork is amazing and beautifully complements the fantastic story. And here's John's unique rating. John gives this 10 honky laundromat clowns out of 10. If you know, you know. And hey, guess what? My review for this week is Blatant Corporate Collusion with Team Tealmore, as I gush about Joanne Scranton and Gabby Moraes' book, Kathy Q Builds a Time Machine, recently released. And not only because Gabby Moraes is the illustrator for my debut, Naked, out this December. I loved this book way before Gabby and I partnered up for Naked, because obviously Gabby's illustrations are lush, colorful, and extremely engaging. The story is STEM adjacent and bootstrappy, as Kathy Q is a go-getter who gets things done, but in a kind of a preposterous way. We love a story where things go haywire, and they do here in big and ridiculous ways. Gorgeous book, silly premise, fun words. Three really key prerequisites for a good picture book. Okay, I'm going to get out of the way of the rest of our awesome conversation with Adam Rex. Now back to Adam's verse.
I want to just reinforce the point that you were making, which you said was a bad answer. I don't think so. I think you're a more sort of like mature version of something that we talk about a lot in a jokey way, which is, hey, if you want an agent, if you want to get published, you have to have a book first. I think if you want to make an axiom out of the experience that you've had is the kind of old adage of, be so good that you can't be ignored. I'm paraphrasing whatever that quote is. You're 20 plus years down, further down the path of being a creative who started by just doing your thing, making excellent work and getting noticed. And I think that's what we all hope for. And unfortunately, the reality is in 2020, the market is so fragmented and spread out that that's probably not possible to the extent that we might hope anymore. However, having something out there, there are houses that are open for unagented submissions. Part of this is me just reminding myself that this is possible too. As someone without an agent, it is possible to make that happen, and it does help get your foot in the door, for your next thing.
Yeah, and I always, I'm sure you all talk about SCBWY a lot on this podcast, and I don't know whether you're members or how you feel about it, but I do believe in the value of sitting down with people, meeting them face to face, shaking hands if you shake hands, all those things that I think predispose people towards wanting to help you out in ways that they're not necessarily even aware of themselves. SCBWI didn't help me at the time when I would have needed it. Back in the 90s, I sort of reached out to their national chapter because I couldn't seem to find any evidence of an Arizona chapter because there wasn't one at the time. There is a healthy one now, but they're just, they were telling me a very poor recent college grad that if I wanted to do SCBWI, I just needed to go to the California events, which were an 8-hour drive away. And nonetheless, I used to make that drive because when I got started in in the illustration business. It was actually not as a kid's book illustrator, but it was at a, as a, an illustrator of role-playing games and collectible card games and stuff like that, Magic the Gathering and Dungeons and Dragons and whatnot. And I got that work because I drove out to the San Diego Comic-Con every summer and slept in my car and showed my portfolio around to anyone who would look at it. So at that point, I already felt tapped out in the drive all the way to a major city in Southern California and sleep in my car while I show my work to people. So I didn't take the SCBWI advice that I was getting, but it had already served me well going out to Comic-Con every year and showing my work and shaking hands and looking people in the eye. And work came out of that in a way that I'm not sure that it would have if I was just sending submissions blind through the mail. I don't know. And all of this is, I always feel weird about it. It's like the self-mythologizing of like having slept in my car and slept my portfolio around like that. You know, I was able to do that because of a good support system that I had that allowed me to take those chances. But nonetheless, that was me in the mid-90s.
I very much identify with that as not that I drive places and sleep in my car and try to show out my, you know, break out my Google Docs and show my stories to people, but it's a similar mindset. My husband and I met because we were rock climbers. We met in Korea when he was doing that guidebook. And that's very much the rock climber mentality. That's very much like in the subculture of climbing, like you showing up is, you know, 75% of it. Like you drive to these crags, you sleep in your car, you eat cat food if you're Yvonne Chouinard, who is the founder of Patagonia. Like you do these things because you love it so much. So you just want to climb. And so you eat pasta for, you know, weeks at a time because it costs $7 or whatever. And you sleep in your car and you wear the same clothes and you don't shower and you just because you know, that's the love of climbing. And it's there's a lot of crossover there. I very much appreciate that you did that. I love that a lot.
This is Brenna self-mythologizing there.
Yeah, that was my life, like early 2000s. I, you know, that is what I did. And I had been climbing for a long time before I moved to Korea and met my husband. And we, you know, bonded over that sort of like dirtbag lifestyle. And then we moved back to the States, bought a van and did more of it because that's how much we loved it. So anyways, yeah.
I think so there's a lot of climber like you, like a rock climber, right?
Well, it feels very far away from how I live now and what I do now, where I look back on early in my career. And I guess a lot of people have this trajectory, but you know, it was all hustle and sleeping in my car and pulling all-nighters and just constantly working at putting that portfolio together that was going to open that door. And now I'm 50 years old and I don't pull all-nighters anymore. And I think, oh, I'll just tell them the book's going to be late. And so that's where I'm at now. So maybe I need to get a little bit more of that rock climber mentality back. I don't know.
Go eat some cat food, Adam.
I know they make granola bars. I mean, like, why do we need cat food? Like, even baby food. I don't know. I don't know what was going on with the founder of Patagonia.
Yeah,
I didn't notice about it.
Yeah, no, it's in his book. It's because that was the cheapest thing. It was like on sale or whatever, and they didn't have any money for like gas or anything else. And then they started selling gear out of the back of his car. Like they had started to make like the original like trad gear, and that's, you know, that was like sort of the linear move into Patagonia. You know, it's a long stretch from there, but it was like that is how he started. And originally he was a surfer, but then he got into climbing and then he made the trad gear and then whatever. And then he started making money and he didn't have to eat cat food anymore. But
that
is what he did. And it was sort of like, right. Yeah. He just really wants to, you know, get in touch with his roots. And so every once in a while, it breaks out the cat food.
It's a grounding exercise for sure.
Yeah. But I do. Okay. So you came out with three books this year though. And I do want to, so I have this one still from the library. I've kept it for a while, like way past due because I wanted to chat about it. So this is Oh No, the Ants Are Here. And this one, Adam, I cannot tell you like how much this one speaks to me. My mom is one of 10 and she has 8 sisters and 2 brothers. So I very much identify with, oh no, the ants are coming. I have so many of them. And it's like this like sort of cult in my family. Like, are the ants going to be there? Well, are they coming? Like, so I love so much that you wrote this book. And I guess my question is like, do you have a big family? Is this written from your life?
Not, it's written from my wife's life and my intersection with my wife's life. I don't have a very big family, but my wife has a much bigger family. And I've, you know, throughout our courtship and marriage, I have made many treks to the family reunion that they used to have every 2 years in Lebanon, Tennessee. And so I have a lot of exposure to her extended family. Her mom has just three sisters, but that's where this came from, where very early on when my wife and I were just dating, I don't think we had been dating for more than a few months, she asked me, would you like to come on a trip with me to the Grand Canyon, and also my mom, and also my mom's three sisters? And I really liked my girlfriend, who is now my wife, so I said yes. And so, you know, I feel like that was the kernel of this, where I was actually working on a different book. I was working on a book called On Account of the Gum. On Account of the Gum is about a kid who gets gum stuck in their hair and the escalating remedies of trying to get it out. But one of the characters in the book is this aunt who has her own ideas about how to get the gum out. And so I had an aunt character to illustrate. And what that always means is I'm going to fill up, you know, sketchbook pages, or maybe just, you know, Photoshop files of just drawings of the character over and over again, different iterations. What if I try shorter hair? What if I try bigger eyes? You know, I'll draw 50, 100 ants just to figure out what, you know, this one ant is going to look like. So I had filled up a few pages of my sketchbook with all of these ants and glasses and sun visors and sensible haircuts. And I, looking at all of them at once, I had this kind of flashback to this trip that I had taken with my wife and her mom and my wife's aunts back in, I don't know, it must have been 1998, maybe 99. And just always being around for several days, these very energetic, full of personality Southern women, very opinionated Southern women. They kept on telling me their opinions of me. They kept trying to fix my hair. They kept on comparing me unfavorably to cute waiters that they obviously thought that my wife should be dating instead. And so I looked at all these drawings of ants in my sketchbook, and I wrote, oh no, the ants are here. And then immediately I wanted to work on that book rather than the book I was working on. So I wrote a draft of what would become Oh No, the Ants Are Here, just about the, I hope, semi-universal overwhelming feeling of family descending on your house, or you going to a family reunion or what have you, and just, you know, all of these people that you kind of love, but you also kind of don't really know it all. And everybody keeps telling you that you remember them, but you don't, because, you know, you're a kid and 3 years ago was a long time. And so this, the feeling of that, and having your room taken over and seeing them with all of their weird habits and strange smells and all the stuff that comes along with just having family intrude into your life.
This is, of course, not to suggest that your wife's aunts have weird smells.
Well, this weird smell thing that actually comes directly from another experience of my maternal grandmother visiting when I was a kid. And after she left, there would be one room in the house that just smelled like Bengay for like a month and a half afterward.
Okay, that's pretty universal.
All right. Yeah, very universal. And the taking over of the bedroom so reminded me of the scene in 16 Candles where the kid gets kicked out of his room because the grandparents are there or whatever. And yeah. Sam, the main character, comes in and she's like, "Where am I supposed to sleep? Where am I supposed to sleep?" And he's all like, "Sofa City, sweetheart." I love that line. Like, he's just like, "You got to get out of here." She's like, "Great. Where am I supposed to go?"
Yeah, 16 Candles has a lot of problems right with it, to the extent that I probably would not recommend it to anyone in the year 2023. But I, as soon as you said that, I realized, oh, I think you're right. I think that was actually in there. That, you know, in that movie, all of the family is in the house at once because of a wedding. And yeah, I think 16 Candles was probably part of the mix as well. I just didn't realize it until now.
Yeah. Also, real quick, in the back of this book, in your bio, which I read, it says that you worked on a book with Paul Feig. I didn't know that. That's Paul Feig, like the director, Paul Feig from The Office.
That's right. Yeah. And I worked on a book with him in the sense that I illustrated a collection called Guys Read Humor. And so that was a collection of short stories by Paul Feig, Mac Barnett, John Cheska, Kate DiCamillo, Christopher Paul Curtis, and others. And so, yeah, I get the bragging rights of being able to say that I illustrated a Paul Feig story, even if, you know, I'm not sure if Paul Feig remembers my having done that at this point.
I mean, that's amazing. I saw that name was like, I've got to ask about Paul Feig.
Yeah, I'm sure you made an impression. Don't undersell yourself.
Underselling myself is what I do. I mentioned earlier that I need an agent for that reason. Otherwise, I would probably still be getting like the $8,000 advance to illustrate an entire picture book like I got back in the year 2000.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. So let's talk just quickly, or maybe not quickly, but I want to talk about the third book that came out this year, A Lot Like Waking. So did you... How did that work? Were you working on these books simultaneously and then they all came out, or was it sort of staggered and then they just all ended up coming out in the same year?
Three books coming out in one year is not something you should want to have happen. It was because I was working on A Little Like Waking for a really long time. I've been thinking about that book for, you know, it's been more than 10 years, and I worked on several different iterations of it. It actually started out as a film pitch to DreamWorks, which they bought and started working on, and then abruptly stopped working on, and I just kept working on it. But then it turned into a short story and then more of a novella, and now finally into the illustrated novel that it is now. But it was a book that, it was a very slow process with editorial. There was sort of some shakeups going on and on the editorial side that I had to wait to settle down. And so it was kind of for that reason that this book came out when it really, you know, it could have come out an entire year earlier, I think, if the editorial process had gone a little more smoothly. And I was very happy, I want to say, with the editors that I worked with, and I think we made a good book, but it was just a lot of delays. So it was because of those delays that this book ended up coming out just 2 weeks before the story of Gumluck the Wizard, which is not what you want to have happen. You know, I spent a solid month just begging social media to buy my new YA novel. And the moment I stopped doing that, I started right in on begging social media to buy my new chapter book series about a silly little wizard. And I don't like asking people for anything to begin with, so that was a little rough. But so that's why that shook out. I mean, otherwise with Oh No, The Answer Here, you know, one of the benefits of occasionally not illustrating my own work is that I can be done with a picture book manuscript for the most part. I can hand it off to somebody else and I can be working on something while they're working on that.
I think A Little Like Waking is fascinating, but I think what's more fascinating, not more fascinating, but something that I want to ask about is it's the reality now that it began as a movie pitch. Is that something that you work with Steve on? Also, was that going to be directed by Christopher Nolan, because that's kind of like where I would see as a sort of like absurdist dreamlike world, story being depicted. I'm curious about that. I want to loop in, treemining a smek day and smek for president. Like how do you work with ideas, turning ideas into film and TV? This is something that we've danced around in other conversations, but not to the extent that I think that your career has seen.
Well, so Steve Mulk partners with several film and television agents. And so he's sort of feeding things to them and working with them to try to make things happen. And, you know, The True Meaning of Smek Day, that was my first novel. That was, you know, a colossal stroke of luck and probably something that's never going to repeat itself in my lifetime. But it got interest right away, first from a smaller production company, and then purely by luck by DreamWorks, who then bought the option from that smaller production company and started working on it themselves. And the reason that DreamWorks was working on it is I'd like to be able to give credit to the agents that I work with, but that one was actually, most credit is due to a librarian who wrote a review for the New York Times of The True Meaning of Smek Day. And your listeners may know that, you know, most books don't get reviewed by the New York Times. Most children's books don't. So just getting a review of note in the New York Times is a pretty big deal. And so because of that review in the New York Times, the future director of the movie Home read it, decided to order it and read it to his sons. And then the way he tells it is the first night he was reading it to his sons, he read some section of it, he put them to bed, and then he took it into the living room and continued reading it all the way through the end, and then brought it into DreamWorks the next day and said, this is going to be the next movie that I want to work on. And that's probably a certain amount of mythologizing as well. But he decided that he felt strongly that this was something he wanted to develop and see if it could turn into a movie. And so many things that production companies option, you know, don't get very far. They do buy the option, but then it just sort of fizzles out. And this was the one that didn't. So eventually it got greenlit. I think it was late 2007 that DreamWorks bought the option, but it wasn't until 2011 that I found out for sure that they were actually going to make the movie. And so then after that, because the movie came out and suddenly I was a name that was attached to something, I had the privilege of being able to get anybody in Hollywood to take a phone call from me for about 6 months. And so that was when DreamWorks asked me to come back in and just pitch any other ideas that I happened to have. And I took this very rudimentary, half-baked idea of, you know, what if you were certain you were in your waking life, but then you saw some irrefutable proof that you were actually in a dream. Somebody flew by, or yes, you know, you went to class and everybody was naked during the geography final or whatever. Some sort of typical dream scenario. What if that intruded on what you were certain was your waking life? How would you react to that? And how would you solve the problem of that? And so I very quickly sort of wrote up a pitch, and I flew to DreamWorks and I pitched it to somebody. And I am proud to say that it got a reputation around there as being the best pitch that they had ever heard. At least that's what I was told afterwards. And so they...
Nice.
They started developing it. It never had a director. And I think Christopher Nolan writes his own stuff, doesn't he? But it did have a screenwriter. And
I think so.
They were working on it.
Yeah.
They were working on it and developing it. And then, as so often happens, I'm told in Hollywood, the guy who had really spearheaded it was let go from DreamWorks, and his replacements didn't care about it. So that was that. So that I had already sort of written into my contract with them that, like, I would like to continue working on my own version of this. So I had been working on it. And, you know, after it fizzled out at DreamWorks, I I just kept writing it, and it just kept getting longer and longer. And eventually I found a publisher for it, and they agreed that it could be an illustrated YA, which is not something you see very often. And so I'm really happy with the way it's turned out now.
What would you have done, or what would have been your desired path had they proceeded with it? Would you, to your understanding, at least as far as any of this is consistent, would you have worked with the screenwriter to make sure the stories were consistent? I guess it becomes sort of a novelization of something that began as a movie at that point. I'm curious how you would have handled that.
I think my novelization would have been entirely its own thing. I was never going to write an actual novelization of whatever they ended up with in the script. And I mean, regarding that script, it was already going off in a direction that I was just like, really? But I have never in my two experiences with movie makers, I have not yet really put my foot down in any real way to say, like, I need script approval, or you need to work with me. This needs to follow my designs and my vision. I guess I just have a self-deprecating idea that if somebody like me really put my foot down, they would probably just say, well, you know, then thank you anyway, and then move on to somebody else who is being a little less difficult. You know, I'm not somebody like a Rick Riordan who probably gets to, you know, throw his weight around a little bit. They were probably just going to make their own thing, and that's okay too. Because, you know, the book is the book, and I'm not really one of those people that says, like, oh, you ruined the book by making a movie that's did not follow it beat for beat or disappointed me in whatever way. You know, the book is still there.
So, Adam, I know we're already past an hour and you've been so generous with your time. The last thing I wanted to say or just speak about real quick is, so one, my son loves, he thinks that book is hilarious. We have to get it from the library constantly. I would buy my own copy, but we're about to move, so I'll have to put it on the list for when we get to Colorado. And second, my all-time favorite Adam Rex book is Unstoppable. I love that book so much, and I would love to hear, like, the backstory of that one and how that came to be, because I love that one. That's one for me that I'm like, I need that, like, in my library.
Well, and for listeners who don't understand what we're doing, that title is P-S-S-S-T exclamation point. You might want to steal that from the library and just pay whatever fine you accrue, because that one was out of print. You can't buy it anymore. Maybe you could find a used copy somewhere.
Oh, but shoot.
Yeah, that one went out of print.
Okay.
But Unstoppable is a book about animals who discover that they're stronger together if they team up into new, you know, amalgam animals, like a Burdra-Burdle-Bird. Burdra-Burdle-Crab? I'm in the weird position of trying to remember when I actually wrote this up. But, you know, a bird and a crab team up, a bird and a crab team up in with a turtle. It escalates from there. And I, frankly, sometimes I can tell you where stories come from and sometimes I can't. And that was one of the ones that in 2023, I have no idea whatsoever anymore where that story came from or how I thought of it. I don't remember anymore. And I don't remember because I think it was one of those stories that just came to me almost whole cloth. Like, you know, what if a couple animals teamed up and decided to be a new animal that had all of the strengths of both and none of the weaknesses. So I'm really glad you like that book. That was illustrated by Laura Park. And she worked with me again on another book that came out late last year called Digestion the Musical, a sort of a Broadway stage musical about the digestive system that I'm also really proud of. And, you know, we didn't mention...
I love it so much.
You talked about Oh No, the Answer here, and I need to say that was illustrated by Leanne Cho. It was the first time I've worked with her, but she just really knocked it out of the park. She did a perfect job on that.
Yeah, totally.
I have to just observe, or I have to just voice my mental image that Unstoppable came to you over like a surf and turf dinner. You were enjoying a nice like multi-animal pairing for dinner, and that's where it came from.
And I love the ending where it's like they just just out of nowhere they're like, oh, I know, let's be president, like we should totally be able to do this and like make this happen. And it like I don't know, I love everything about notch. That book. It's yeah it's my favorite thing.
Yeah, that's the way it is with some of those escalating books where you don't it's interesting when you keep kind of pushing things farther and farther, like the bird and the crab team up. They team up with a turtle. Then there's a bear, and that's sort of a big jump forward. And then where do you go from bear? And so, like the worst thing you can do with a book like that is just have it kind of peter out, you know? So usually I think the solution is to go huge so that you kind of explode the whole thing, and then, you know, you slip away while everything is exploding.
Yeah, no denouement to a story like that, for sure. Well, we haven't gotten to talk about my version of Brenna's connection with you over Korea. My version of that is the illustrations for Magic the Gathering and Dungeons and Dragons. I was an avid Magic the Gathering player back in high school, and I still have my cards, and I wonder now if my Converse shoebox of like beta Magic the Gathering cards has any Adam Rex originals in it. I'm going to have to go back and look. Kind of clearly see, knowing that reality, some of the influence in how you illustrate and how you approach your, you know, sort of the richness of composition and things. It's very sort of lush in that same style. But yeah. I'm gonna have to go back and look at my cards. That's my conclusion.
Yeah, it'll depend on when you were collecting. I started with them, I want to say 95, 96, and kept illustrating for them well into the 2000s. And then, you know, once my kids' book career took off, I sort of left them behind for a while. But I've actually gone back to it recently. I've done a handful of cards in the last few years, just for the fun of it. And also because I realized I just was never oil painting anymore. So now it's an excuse to actually oil paint instead of doing everything digitally all the time. But yeah, that was a good experience working on those. And what was your question? I think I lost track of it.
I didn't have a question so much as just an observation. I think the question version of that was just walking through the existence of that, connecting that sort of like trudge over to San Diego and sell your illustration and really toil away, must have been something like a way to refine both your work habits as well as your skill set in terms of how you approach illustration, how you approach storytelling through images.
Yeah, I think working on for D&D and Magic the Gathering and other games, it refined a lot of things. It just helped me figure out how I worked and helped me learn to work faster and hopefully better over the years. But it also, I think, trained me to illustrate in a mode that was appropriate to that fantasy illustration world, which is not necessarily, you know, all that easy to reconcile with the kids' book world. The kids' book world that celebrates not Frank Frazetta and Boris Vallejo, but, you know, John Clausen and Carson Ellis. So, you know, definitely right. I could not take any of my Magic the Gathering stuff and put it in a portfolio for the use of showing to an editor in picture books and say, like, it is, you know, it's an orc with a bloody axe. But if you look past that, you can see that there's some storytelling. And obviously, I know how to draw and paint. And it didn't matter.
See what they I
needed
might
to
do.
Be shown
yeah, right.
They needed to be shown. You don't, they don't have to use their imagination and be able to look at your work and decide that, oh, I bet he could do kids' books too, because like not everybody can. So I had to make art that was really appropriate to a children's book portfolio. And it's, you know, it's led me to be, I've always been in this kind of strange place where I feel like as far as fantasy illustration goes, I was considered to be the kind of sloppy, loose guy. And as far as children's book illustration goes, I'm the uptight over-renderer who obviously, you know, cut his teeth on Dungeons and Dragons illustrations. So it's been the work of my children's book career to try to loosen up more, to try to continue to cultivate something that really is like a good look for a kid's book and not just a fantasy card art illustration, albeit aimed at a 6-year-old.
Right. Well, ending vision, I can't help but imagine now a magic card for Gumluck or for Patches. We'll just end on that.
Yes, Adam, thank you so much for coming on. This has been amazing. I've seen you talk several times and it was really nice to sit down and actually chat with you about stuff. And I think a lot of stuff came up that, hasn't been talked about before, which I always love because, you've been around for a long time. Questions have been asked, you've answered things. And I hope that we didn't ask, all the same old stuff. I feel like we got, new information and new insights. So I really appreciate you coming on. This has been great.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. And I do appreciate being asked something I haven't been asked before. So this has been a really good experience. Thank you.
Thanks for listening this week.
Find all of our episodes and other associated links and information at linktree.com/verseshow.
Or reach out to us on Twitter. Thanks again, and we'll see you next verse.
Bye!